All right, dear friends. Hey, you need to know something. A little while ago, we were setting up for this show, and Derek did the rooster. He just did it into the mic, and he sounded exactly like my rooster, which was me many years ago when I made that sound. Many of you don't know that, but that was me. It was I. Sounding like the bird. And there's a whole story behind that. I'm not going to get into it now, but Derek apparently has been listening to it for so long now. He internalized it. He could do the exact thing. He can do the bird if I'm not here or we lose that recording. We'll just open the blinds, let the sun come in, and Derek can do his cock-a-doodle-doo. Hey, thank you for joining me today. I am Greg Kokel, this individual who's running on about the bird right now, about the rooster. And I want to spend my hour talking about something that is really critical to the truth of Christianity. It's actually something I talk about or around constantly, or maybe not constantly, but frequently, because of the challenge that this idea in our culture, deeply embedded in our culture, has had on Christianity, or I should say a challenge it's been to Christianity. And I have often said that that there are many ways to prove Christianity is false. In fact, not too long ago, I wrote a piece, a mentoring letter about how if Jesus did not rise from the dead, well, then Christianity is false. I said that I titled it one thing, that you can prove that Christianity is false, and that's the way to do it. And of course, I'm not alone in this. That's what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we are of most men to be pitied because we have believed contrary to fact in something that is really important and we have governed our lives after. But there's a lot of issues like that. The atheist, an atheist wrote a piece in response and was very excited that he found a Christian that would admit that we could demonstrate how Christianity would be false. Incidentally, he went after the evidence that I gave for the resurrection. And the evidence, if the evidence he thinks is comprised, that doesn't prove it's false. It's if the resurrection didn't happen, okay? And that's what proves it's false, not whether you can prove whether the resurrection happened. Anyway, another issue for another day. But the issue that has been troublesome is the way our culture approaches the issue of truth. Now, in the ancient tradition of which we are participants, given our commitment to biblical truth. But when I say ancient, I don't mean just Bible. I mean ancient like the ancients, the way people have thought about this like forever and ever up until just recently. Their idea was there are actual things you could know to be so about the world that we live in. And when there is an actual thing that we know to be so about our world, that is when we use the word truth. Characteristically, there are variations of the word, just like any other word. There can be innuendo is not the right word, but there could be different ways that the word can be used, but it has a foundational kind of notion. And the way Aristotle put it, speaking of the ancients, if you say that a thing is and it is, or you say that a thing isn't and it isn't, well, then your statement is true. Now, if you say a thing is and it isn't, or if you say a thing isn't and it is, well, that's false. Now, I know what you're thinking. Aristotle got credit for that? I could have done that. You're right. Anybody could have done that. Because that is the garden variety understanding of what the word truth means, okay? Sometimes we say that was a true response. We mean it's an authentic response. There's a lot of truth in that movie, or the actors told the truth. And what they mean is they're kind of living out an authentic experience. But almost every time, apart from those exceptions, that we are using the word truth, we mean it in a very simple, straightforward fashion. Greg's going to be on the show today. Really? It's not Tuesday. It's Thursday. Are you right? Yes, I am. Really? Is that true? Now, what is a person asking that question? What are they asking? They're asking, is it so that, as a matter of fact, Mr. Kokel would be broadcasting on a different day than he normally broadcasts, because that's a little unusual. And if I am, then the statement is true. Now, this is not a very complicated notion. And there are some people who contest that definition of truth, which classically is known as truth as correspondence. That is, when we say that something is true, we mean that the statement or the proposition or the belief in question actually corresponds to, in reality, the thing to which it's referring. Okay? And that's what makes it true. Back to Aristotle, if you say that it is and it is, then that's true. Okay? But there's some people who say, well, that's not really what truth means. Well, we have pragmatic views of truth. We have coherence views of truth. We have all kinds of other views of truth. And that may be true the way, did you notice that? I just caught myself. That may be an accurate statement in the way that some people use the term truth, but it isn't the way we normally use the word truth, including how I just used it a few moments ago. Normally, it's just the standard garden variety version of correspondence. Now, if one wants to jettison that notion as a definition of truth, well, then we're just going to have to find some other word that means that. Because that's what we mean when we talk about things, and our words are only useful if our words capture the meanings in our minds that we're trying to communicate with the words. So part of what I'm saying is all these kind of attempts to undermine the notion of truth in terms of its meaning, et cetera, aren't going to work, because we have a common human experience of the world, and we use language to describe that experience, and the experience is one of at least seeming to discover facts. And when we describe those facts, we use a certain word to point out that we think we've stumbled upon a fact, and that word is truth. Even the word fact is similar. It's a synonym, at least the way I'm using it. It's a fact about the world. Now, some have fussed about, well, because since it's a fact about the world, that is about something out there, not something inside me, it's something out there. We're talking about the way the objective realm is. Those are called objective truths. Now, if I'm talking about just something that's a personal belief or preference I have, Häagen-Dazs butter pecan ice cream is delicious, which, by the way, for the record, is no longer my favorite. That ended about 30 years ago when I started giving these talks, because when I'd use this as an illustration, people kept buying me Häagen-Dazs butter pecan, and I got sick of it. So now I've got a different favorite, but I'm not telling you, because I don't want anybody to bring it to an event, which has happened in the past. They brought the ice cream to an event. I had my event and then had a Häagen-Dazs butter pecan milkshake at the end on my drive home. Anyway. So that kind of thing is completely subjective. It's completely up to me. It has nothing to do with the outside world. Whether that flavor of ice cream is good or not, as a matter of fact, is entirely up to me. It could be good today and bad tomorrow. Like it is, actually. It used to be good for me, good to me. Now it's not good to me. To my tastes, I have another favorite. And it's a 31 flavor. But I'm not giving you any more detail than that, for my self-preservation. But when we're talking about something out there, we're talking about the objective world. We call it an objective truth. Now, some have quibbled about this objective and subjective. And in fact, the very first time I had a debate about this issue, relativism, which I'll give a more crisp definition of in just a moment, I was at Cal State University, Northridge, CSUN, they call it, and I was debating on the issue of relativism. And it was actually like 6 days after 9/11. And it was in a big auditorium, and there's a big crowd there. And the issue was the moral version of relativism. That is, there is no objective right or wrong, which the current events at the moment played well into my hand, because the events of the week prior had stimulated people's moral common sense, what philosophers call moral intuition. And so I had a nice, clear case example of evil to point to in my debate. But I was making the case for objective evil, and the good professor, Magliocco, was fussing about the word objective versus subjective, because there's a different way of understanding objective. Objective could mean a feature of the objective world, or it could mean that you have an undistorted understanding of something. That is, you are completely objective about the way you see something. Well, of course, that's virtually never the case, because as subjects, we see through our eyes and our experiences, and there are things like bias that enter in, confirmational bias, for example, that does change our perspective a little bit and has a distorting effect. Now, what some people want to do is, pardon the word, absolutize that, and this is what she was saying, making the point that there is nothing that we see that does not come from ourselves. There's nothing we perceive or think or assess or evaluate that doesn't come from ourselves, and we are subjects. So in one sense of the word, everything is subjective. Everything we know is subjective. But notice that there's a little play on the words going on there. We call this equivocation, when the same word is being used in a different sense in a discussion, and it causes problems. Okay, it makes a little mess of things, and that's what's going on here. When I say there is objective truth in the world, I am saying that there are facts to be learned about the world in itself that we can actually know. I am not saying that every assessment I make of the world is completely uninfluenced by any personal thing that's going on inside of me. Okay? Although I could probably imagine some examples of that when I'm doing my sums. There it is. It's either right or it's wrong. And if it's wrong, I find out soon enough when I double check, as I usually do, my own hand math against the calculator. Okay? And in the process, I find out what the actual truth of the matter is if I have been mistaken. But I'm not always mistaken. Which means even though I'm a subject with my own points of view and my own perspectives and, yes, my own confirmational biases, I can still discover facts about the world. I can still discover objective truth. In fact, there's a very simple example about how to demonstrate that this is a regular thing that we do every day. And when I'm talking to an audience, I'll often ask for a show of hands of how many came to that facility, that venue, for the very first time that day. And people will raise their hands. And I said, how did you get here? And variously, they had a map, or they used a GPS, or they followed instructions to arrive at that location. Notice what took place, I point out to them, when you did that. You took a claim about the world, which is all that a map amounts to. It is a piece of paper with symbols on it that is meant to communicate something about the topography of the world as it actually is. And by assessing the map, especially if it's reasonably accurate, you can take the claim of the map that is a representation of geography, which is a segment of reality, and you can test it against the actual geography, which is a portion of reality, and see if it tells the truth. How would you know if it tells the truth? You drive and you arrive. That's how you can find out. And whether it's a map or a GPS or even instructions people give you, these are all claims about the nature of the real world. You put them to the test, and no matter how biased you happen to be, you might have a confirmational bias that is so strong that you would never give these instructions to somebody else. But when you follow these instructions dutifully and end up at the very venue that has outside a marquee that says Greg Kokel speaking tonight, then you know, contrary to your bias, the instructions were correct. And by the way, nobody chooses to believe that. You don't choose your beliefs. You believe things because you are compelled by the evidence in front of you. This, by the way, is not a controversial idea. This notion of choosing our beliefs is called doxastic voluntarism, if you want a big fancy word, but it just means you choose your beliefs, but you don't. You choose how to respond to what you believe, but you don't choose to believe. You are listening to this broadcast. You believe that it's me, but you are not choosing to believe that. You can't just choose to believe that I'm Tim Barnett or John Noyes or Alan Schliemann, because you know differently. You recognize my voice. And therefore, you're compelled to believe the fact that this is me. All of this is meant to show that we have the faculties to be able to determine what is true about the world, at least in some sense, and I want to add some vital sense. Because if you couldn't know, if you were not capable of knowing in virtue of your experience or perspective or subjectivism or however you wanted to characterize it, if you weren't capable of knowing certain facts, truths, about your world, the way the world actually is, you would be dead in one day. You're driving down the highway. No, not highway, because there's a divider. Just a regular road, 55 miles an hour. The only thing that divides you from the deadly oncoming traffic is a yellow line and your capability to assess the environment accurately so you don't kill yourself. Your ability to know truth in that split moment keeps you alive, keeps you from pulling over on the other side of the road and having a head-on collision. So those are just, you know, very simple, straightforward kinds of illustrations about how it is you know truth, and therefore you should not be in the slightest bit intimidated by others who press hard against you to insist that everything that you know turns out to be simply a subjective point of view. Now, when I just said that, and I want to repeat it again because I want some of you to listen for something else that's going on. Some have already noticed it, but others have not. I don't want you to let anybody convince you if they try to insist that everything you think you know is merely your subjective point of view. What's the problem with that statement? The person who's arguing for relativism in that case is arguing by appealing to an objective notion, which is everything you think you know is just a matter of your own opinion or your own subjective experience. It doesn't tell you anything about the real world. Really? Does that rule apply to what you just told me? Is that just your opinion? Because according to the rule, it would have to be. According to the rule you just offered, it is nothing more than your subjective assessment of things, and it's no closer to reality than anything else. Because, and this is the way this whole idea cashes out, there is no truth. Or at least no truth that can be known, which in practical terms is basically the same thing. Okay, so I'm just giving you a little clue right there as to what is substantially wrong with this view. It's self-refuting. Every time a person makes a claim like this regarding any of your views that you are speaking of and is dismissing them because there is no truth, which, by the way, if it were the case, then Christianity would be out of the running. That would be a defeater, right? Because we claim to know the truth, that it is the truth, that it is an accurate representation of reality. It is the story of reality, indeed. I like that phrase. Maybe I'll use it sometime. That's the claim we're making. And if there's none of that stuff, then we're out of luck. So this is an aggressive attempt to defeat Christianity, and a lot of people are taken in by it. This is something you hear a lot at the university. I'm chuckling because, really, I thought the university was the place you went to learn truth. In fact, it's part of the ancient statements written around campus. The word veritas pops up here and there, and sometimes in the mission, the ancient mission of the university, veritas, Latin for truth. But many of these schools have abandoned the notion that you can, that there is such a thing, okay, which makes me wonder why people are going to the university and paying exorbitant prices for it. If it's kind of a bait and switch, right? I want my money back. But in any event, it's really popular. And you can see kind of the end around. That this whole enterprise represents for Christianity, that if people are convinced that there is no truth, or maybe they think there are some truth like scientific truth, but there's no religious truth, then you're still in the same hole, then Christianity can't be that. And by and large, they are convinced of that. Let me give you an illustration of just how this kind of a metaphor of sorts to kind of make my point from a different angle. You know, many of you read the Chronicles of Narnia, for example. Not the Chronicles, the other one, the Fellowship of the Ring. Those three books, actually three plus one, because The Hobbit was the first one. And there in Middle-earth, hobbits lived in a kind of isolated region and very far from elves and dwarves. They lived in Hobbiton, right? And if you were a hobbit living in Hobbiton and somebody said they actually saw an elf, it would be really unusual. And unlikely, maybe, but not impossible, because in that world there were elves. And on occasion, I guess they could stroll away from the place that they usually lived and show up where hobbits usually lived. But if you did say you saw an elf in Hobbiton, you'd be some dispute, right? Are you sure it was an elf? Are you sure? Maybe it was something you mistook for an elf. Maybe you were dreaming. Maybe you didn't have your glasses on. Maybe it was twilight, you couldn't see very clearly. But the questions would be enjoined only because seeing an elf somewhere in Middle-earth was at least a possibility, because elves actually existed in that world. But what if somebody made the same claim in this world? Well, I think the claim in most circles, there's always exceptions to these things, but in most circles the claim would not even be countenanced. And the reason is because elves and hobbits and dwarves, for that matter, do not exist in this world. And if they do not exist, it does not make any sense debating whether you actually saw an elf or were mistaken about what you thought you saw. Okay? At best, you might discuss why you would ever think you saw something that does not exist. And if you persisted, your sanity might even be questioned. Okay? Well, that little story there is a picture of the situation that we face today. You know, Jesus told Pilate, I have come to bear witness to the truth. All right? This is core to the Christian enterprise, to the Christian world view. But there is a kind of revolution in our midst precisely on this issue, and that revolution has been going on a long time. I'm almost 70, so during the 60s, I was in high school and in college, and in the 70s, college, when I became a Christian. And all of this started turning over then, because the Enlightenment way of looking at the world was very, very deeply entrenched in the academy, and properly so, because it wasn't just an Enlightenment view, it was an ancient view, that there were things you could actually know to be true. And that we had have faculties that are adequate to help us discover those things that are actually true. And in a number of different areas, certainly the Enlightenment questioned whether we can know truth in the moral or the religious realm, but at least the physical realm was wide open to that. But even that is, in a certain sense, in question now, because everything is relative, at least to some people. At least that's the way they talk. And by the way, and maybe I'll get to this later, just because people talk this way doesn't mean they believe this way. Let me say it again. Just because people talk this way doesn't mean they believe this way. In the new edition, the 10th anniversary edition of the Tactics book, I have a new chapter called Inside Out. And that's a tactic that's not so much a maneuver, but a frame of mind, a way of looking at things that reminds us that there have been many things that have been built inside of every human being in virtue of being human. It's part of what it means to be in the image of God, built there by God, and those human beings in the image of God live in the world that God made. And that means there are lots of things they know that they can't not know. And morality is one of them. And this is why even when people deny morality, they still make moral claims about things. They'll say, hey, there is no objective morality. There's just personal opinions. Therefore, it's wrong for you to push. You know how the sentence ends, your morality on me. Wait a minute. If there is no objective morality, then how could it be wrong for me to do that? You may think it's wrong for you. Okay, you're welcome to that, but that's not my moral view. I can make my own moral view up on your standards, according to your standards and on your view. So anyway, this is how people have approached this issue, even though they do it inconsistently. People say there is no truth, and then they make all kinds of truth claims that they think are actually factual. People say there is no moral truth, but then make all kinds of truth claims that they take are actually morally factual. So this plays itself out in different ways. What I want to do now is I've kind of moved around this topic a bit in different ways. I want to zero in on a definition of relativism that is the most precise definition that I can find. Okay, I don't know that I really invented it, but I've just taken a lot of things and boiled them down to this essential thing. And this is the core of it, the heart of it. In the past, I've talked about insulin and ice cream kind of comparisons, and relative things are true in an ice cream kind of way, and others are true in an insulin kind of way. So I want to give you the crispest, cleanest definition of relativism versus objectivism. And keep in mind that these terms apply to truth claims. That's what we're talking about here. Whether the claim is implicit or explicit. The car in front of the house is burning. That's an explicit one. The belief that certain things are wrong are implicit. One is expressed propositionally in a statement. The other one is held propositionally in an interior belief. But both are claims about the way the world actually is, or at least presumably. And that's what the question is. What is the nature of these beliefs that people think are so? And sometimes when I'm dealing with high school students or college students, I think the first time I used it was with college students, I'll do an exercise because I want them to get clear on the meaning of truth, which I've already discussed with you a little bit. But the illustration, I think, makes it more concrete. Okay, it reifies an abstract concept. And I hold up a pen and for the audience, and I get them all to look at me. Look, here's an exercise. Watch this. Pay attention. I wave the pen. And then I put the pen on the podium in a way that everyone can see. All right? And then I make a statement. And the statement is, the pen is on the podium. The pen is on the podium. Then I ask two questions. Here's the first question. Is the statement true? And virtually everybody raises their hand. They agree because of the antics that I had just performed. I take the pen. They're watching. I put it on the podium. Now, some maybe can't see it very well, but you get the point. They're all saying, yeah, that is a true statement. The pen is on the podium. Okay. And then I ask this question, and this is the vital question. If it is true, and you think it is, what is it that makes it true? or as some might say, what is the truth maker of the statement the pen is on the podium? Well, then I get hands come up and people make different suggestions. Some will say, well, I can see it there. I say, close your eyes. So they close their eyes. Can you see it now? No. Is it still true? I'm just letting you know that I haven't done any shenanigans up here and removed the pen. So is it still true that the pen is on the podium? Yeah, I guess so. You're right. It is, even though you can't see it. So seeing it there isn't what makes it true. In other words, it's no empirical experience that makes a fact a fact. The empirical experience can help us discover a fact, but it doesn't make it a fact. So then I answer, another hand goes up. Well, it's true because I believe it's true. I say, well, what if you stopped believing it? Would the pen be off the podium? No. Well, then believing it's true doesn't make it true, does it? And so we work around the room a little bit, and sometimes there's a bright student who gets pretty much the right answer. I actually use this illustration. So I noticed, I just thought of it. You know, if you don't believe in gravity, are you going to float away? No, because gravity is still there. And so your beliefs don't create the reality of the world. At least it seems obvious. Now, notice I'm asking these questions when their guards are down. What you're going to find out is there are a lot of people who take exception with the common sense things that I'm pointing out here. And that's where we get into this controversy, and I think a lot of people get into trouble. And how Christians get confused. And so then I tell them, I said, the thing that makes the statement, the pen is on the podium, true, is a pen and a podium and the first resting upon the second. That's what I tell them. In other words, it is some feature of the objective world that makes the statement itself true. Now, this is very straightforward. It's kind of another way or an illustration of something I've been saying since we started this broadcast, that there is a common sense understanding of what the word truth means, and we use it all the time in that way, even though sometimes we get a little confused about how that works. So I don't want you to be confused. And as I said, I don't want you to be in the least wise intimidated by somebody who says, well, there is none of that stuff. There is none of that truth stuff. So you guys are talking about you know the truth, or somebody else, they know the truth. You're arguing, you're wasting your time because there's none of that truth stuff. I was in lectured at Berkeley, at an unbelievable example of this. Oh, this was many years ago, and I had a full crowd. I mean, there was overflow rooms. It was a lot of people there. It was great. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of people. There might have been more than 1,000. I don't know. It was a great turnout, and the church that had sponsored this had done a really good job of getting people out. And it was a relatively peaceful time before the more recent chaos in the universities. But I was talking about, on Friday night, the issue of relativism. And during the Q&A afterwards, there was a Berkeley student that asked me, was pressing me on this particular point, because his point of view is what truth is whatever your culture has taught you to believe. And so therefore your truth claims are all relative to a culture. And of course, some of you are aware, now you're thinking more about this, that he has just made an objectivist truth claim about all truth claims being subjective. Here's the way truth works. Truth is a matter of what your culture says it is, okay? So that's suicidal, again, in terms of the argument destroying itself. But in any event, I was trying to reason with this young man, sweet young man. I thought, okay, well, let's see if we can get a foundation that we can talk about here. And I said, so, listen, this is Berkeley. He was an Asian student, too. You know, a lot of Asian students in math. And in the sciences and stuff like that. And they're very studious for the most part. And so I just ask him, so let me just for clarification, do you think that the square root of 4 is 2? Okay, no, this is a math thing. Just for the record, the square root of 4 is 2. 2 times 2 is 4, okay? Just so you know, what's a square root? The square root of 4 is 2. And so I'm giving a clear case example of a mathematical fact that he should easily affirm that is unrelated to culture. And I'm just using that as a springboard to talk in more detail about this point so he can see that he's making a mistake when he's relativizing everything to culture. And here's what he said to me. He said, that's what my culture has taught me to believe. And then he went on to talk some more about making his other point. He said, wait, stop. Are you telling me that you don't know that the square root of 4 is 2? Well, that's what my culture has taught me to believe. Let's forget about your culture, I said. Just forget about what everybody taught you. Do you understand what the concept of square root is? I asked him. He said, yes. Do you understand what the number 4 means? Yes. Do you understand the number 2 means? Yes. Can't you just see understanding the concepts of 2 and 4 and square rootedness? That 2 just happens to be the square root of 4? Regardless of whatever anybody else told you, can't you just see that? And he said to me, well, that's what my culture has taught me to believe. So I could have asked him, is it a matter of fact that your culture has taught you to believe this? Or did your culture teach you to believe that this is what your culture taught you to believe? And if you say that, then I have the same question again, ad infinitum. So you could see this is in a certain sense a no-brainer, but he wasn't having it. He had been so, and I told him, I said, look, I do not know how it's possible for us to have a discussion any further because we are not even in the same world. And it wasn't a condescending remark. If this is the way a person is going to look at any truth claims, that these are all subjectively determined by the culture, then there is no foundation upon which we can stand to even have a discussion. And that's the way the conversation ended. Now, I was told by some other students that in some of the overflow rooms where they were watching on TV, people were rolling up wads of paper and throwing it at the screen because they were so bugged by this student, because he wasn't willing to give in and admit the obvious. But in any event, it is obvious, and it ought to be obvious to all of us. So this brings us now, having danced around these different examples, to a more precise characterization of what we mean, of what is meant by the terms subjective and relative when applied to the question of truth. All right? A truth that is a subjective truth is a truth that is mind dependent. A truth that is a subjective truth is a truth that depends on a subject, that is an individual mind who holds it to be so. And when the mind disappears, the truth that is held by that mind disappears with it. Back to ice cream. Haagen-Dazs butter pecan ice cream is delicious. That is a truth. That is a truth claim someone makes, and it applies to them because it depends on their point of view and their mind, and that's it. And once they disappear, that truth disappears too. It may reappear in somebody else's mind, but that truth would be just as relative to that subject as the first. And that's why they call this subjective or subjectivistic or mind-dependent truth. Okay? By contrast, truth in the objective sense, truth about the world as it actually is not mind-dependent. It is object-dependent. It is tied to the thing, not to the thinker about the thing. So if I said grass is green, my statement is true if grass actually is green. If it's not green, then it's not true. And it doesn't matter if I believe it's true because the greenness of the grass is not mind dependent. It's dependent on the grass. not on my mind or my perception, which may be faulty, or my sunglasses, which may be colored, or my biases of any sort. It's dependent on the nature of the thing in question. So that's the way to distinguish subjective truth claims from objective truth claims. Now, of course, the debate is whether we can know any objective truth, whether that approach is even legitimate, or as Nietzsche said, all knowledge is perspectival, that is, from the perspective of an individual. Well, I actually, in one sense, agree with that. It is from the perspective of the individual because only individuals have knowledge. Only persons have knowledge. So the knowledge is in their head and from their perspective. But that doesn't mean that the knowledge they have is simply mind-dependent. The knowledge they have, if it's real knowledge, is because they have a belief that fits and matches and corresponds to the world as it actually is, the world as it is in itself. Now, whether that kind of truth exists or not is easy to figure out. We just test our beliefs that we hold in our minds and see if they match the real world. And that's why I gave the map or the GPS illustration. Every single time you pick up your cell phone and you, well, I was going to say dial a number, but that is so archaic. We haven't dialed for decades. Nice alliteration there. We haven't dialed for decades. That's right. We just poke at numbers. But the point is, whenever we dial or poke or whatever, we put in an action into a computerized device that represents certain numbers, and it takes us somewhere. Somewhere else a phone rings, and if the phone that rings is the phone of the person you intended to talk to, then the number you put in there, thinking it was correct, is in fact objectively correct. It's not mind-dependent. Anybody could put that number in. A monkey could put that number in. A computer can put that number in. No mind at all. And would still have the same consequence. Because that is the number, in fact, that corresponds to the individual you're calling. Now, the whole enterprise of trying to figure out what is objectively true versus what is subjectively true, what is mind-dependent and what isn't, well, that is the entire area known as epistemology, which is kind of the philosophical science of knowledge, how we know what we know. Some of you have heard the phrase before. We use it a bit, stand to reason, because it's helpful, and it's a term that does work for us, and it's the right term. So it's a good one to learn when you're talking about knowledge, that you're talking about epistemology. And our whole life is spent trying to figure out what's true and what isn't. Our whole day is spent doing that kind of thing. I'm hungry. Is there anything to eat? Open the refrigerator. There's nothing in there. Well, there's nothing you want. Usually lots of things in the refrigerator. But you get my point. We act in such a way as to assess our environment to find out what is accurate about the environment. Somebody says, hey, watch your step. Why'd they say that? Well, because there's a step right there. And if you don't get the step, if you don't assess it properly in the real world, then in the real world, you're going to be on your face on the sidewalk. All of these are just common sense examples to demonstrate how foolish and empty the claim that there is no truth, or you can't know anything, or you can't know anything for sure, happens to be. Of course you can know things. And of course you can know them for sure. Sure enough that you bet your life on them. You do it every single day. The fact of the matter is, we are truth seekers by nature. It's what we do. Other living things don't do it, at least with the precision and the energy and the intentionality that human beings do. Well, you have three cats, and I don't know, sometimes it looks like they're trying to figure something out. Not usually. You know cats. Nothing going on there. But once in a while, it looks like they're trying to figure things out. So maybe higher animals, because of their minds and the souls they happen to have, though simple, still do some of those things. But humans are unique in the degree to which they do it. And so it seems odd then that the humans, in assessing their world, would come to the conclusion that it's actually a fact that there are no actual facts. And that is the problem with relativism. If you listened of any sort, now we've been speaking of it in the general sense, but you know, I talk about moral relativism. I wrote a book on it with Frank Beckwith, 24 years ago or something like that, 22 is the year I was married. And so we look at the idea of whether moral claims, moral assessments, moral rules are simply mind-dependent. They're just in the mind of the individual or in the collective mind of the group, like in a social contract idea. And in that book, we look at how both of those fail to explain what we actually experience of morality in the world. But that's another enterprise. Well, morality is just relative. You have your morality, I have mine. Really? If that's the case, there's no problem of evil in the world. Huh? Of course there's a problem of evil. Well, how could there be a problem of evil if morals are mind-dependent? Your complaint about evil is that there's so much evil, did you catch my words, in the world. There's a reason why people say, why is there so much evil in the world? Because they think evil is a feature of the world. That is, that it's not mind-dependent. Well, evil is part of the category of morality, in case you hadn't noticed. And that would mean that when you claim or complain about evil in the world, you are saying something about morality that is objective and mind-independent, not morality that is mind-dependent. If you want to argue that morality is just relative, it's just subjective. I do my thing, you do your thing, and I have my rules, you have your rules. What's true for me is not true for you, and you could just run through the litany there. Okay, you're welcome to that, but you're not welcome to the problem of evil, because the problem of evil, as stated characteristically, makes no sense in a relativistic world. There are no real evil things. There's no evil in the world. There's only things that people don't like that are wrong for them. But who should care if there is no objective standard that applies to everybody, including the standard I should care about what other people think? And so it turns out in both cases, both species of relativism, the claim that all truth is mind-dependent, that is, the truth value is dependent on the individual mind and it's not dependent on the object. It's relative to the mind, not the object. Whether you're talking about just things in general, or maybe just narrow it down to religion, yeah, we can know some physics and some chemistry when it comes to religion, to morality, rather. When it comes to morality, no way. Both of those are self-defeating, clearly self-defeating. The second is self-defeating more in practice, and the point I'm making there is that people just know better, and it's evidenced by their language they don't believe what they're saying. If they say it's wrong to judge, okay, well, that's just a statement. If they say you shouldn't be judging me, that's a judgment. And so they are doing the same thing they're telling you not to do. Why are they doing that then? If they don't believe it's right, why are they doing it? People don't see this, though. And so both of these species of relativism, in one way or another, are destructive. Or to put it more simply, we know better. We know better. And when the entire culture, it seems, in many ways, is promoting an idea that is obviously wrong and is also injurious to the Christian worldview. I mean, these are shots right at Christianity. If there is no morality, then there's no sin. If there's no sin, there's no need for a Savior. If there's no need for a Savior, there's no need for Jesus. At least not Jesus as insulin. Maybe Jesus as ice cream, which is the way he is for a lot of people. My key thing is I want you to see what's going on. I don't want you to be taken in by nonsense. I don't want you to be have your convictions undermined, because there's a whole chorus of people screaming falsehoods loudly. And that's what we have here. Listen to the loud falsehood carefully, and even listen to the person who's screaming them, and you will see by the things that they say and the way that they act that they don't even believe them. You listen to them, and you'll see that they're false. Clearly and obviously. You listen to them, you realize they know they're false as well, because they are human beings who are made in the image of God, and they must live in the world that God has made. And as I said at the end, and I'll just close with this, as I said in the end of the book, I should say the chapter of Tactics, which is in the new book, the extended edition, as I said in the Inside Out chapter, people can run from God, but they cannot run from themselves. And sometimes this is a great insight to know how to work with somebody who is obviously denying reality, particularly when it comes to spiritual things. Hope that's helpful, little tutorial on the issue of relativism. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.